CliffCentral.com. So much to get into this this morning on the Burning Platform. If you haven't joined us for one of these before, it's really a current affairs show where we talk about stories that are in the news. We get some commentary, some analysis. We bring you different voices from different places in the political, in the news, in the commentariat sections of South Africa. People who have interesting insights, and hopefully we bring you a diversity of views too. Certainly, if you look at South African media, there seems to be an overrepresentation of a certain narrative in most of the media publications, and we try to counter that with some truth from the other side. And of course, there are people who think that we need to have more of one side than the other, but you're welcome to give us any feedback you like after or during any show by sending us a message to 0797482090, or you can email me, gareth@cliffcentral.com. Canton Pillay will be joining us in just a moment for The Burning Platform. It's brought to you every week by Nando's. We talk about everything, and we're happy to hear your suggestions today too. So, let me reintroduce to you someone who is not unfamiliar to cliffcentral.com, someone who was here at the beginning of our business and the beginning of our broadcasting with the Renegade Report, something that he set up and still does with Jonathan Witt. He is Roman Kabanak. Roman, how are you, dude? Nice to see you.
Good morning, Gareth, and I'm very well, and thank you for introducing me and inviting me to this most auspicious show.
Yeah, I saw on, I don't know what social medium it was, but I saw how excited you were yesterday, and I thought, you know what, actually it's outrageous that we haven't had you more this year. We've had much less erudite people than you a couple more times than that, so.
Well, I mean, we haven't tested the waters yet, so let's see. Yeah, first time here.
I mean, you might
hopefully
be.
Hopefully, I'll get invited.
You might be terrible. Let's not put too much pressure on. But listen, first of all, congratulations on the morning shot. How are we looking there at the moment? How many subscribers have you got going on there?
We're inching up to about 18,500.
That's phenomenal. When did you start this?
January 26th.
This year.
Yes.
And you're almost at 20,000 subscribers.
Well, I have to see it to believe it, but yes, almost. I was expecting, my goal was 5,000 by December. So, yeah, I've no complaints on that side. I'm very happy with the growth.
So. That's very good. So how would you describe the Morning Shot to someone who hasn't heard it before?
So Morning Shot is not an innuendo for anything else other than a coffee shot with all the news that you need in about 10 minutes. So I take two or three stories of the day, add my analysis to it, and that's the morning shot.
All right, very good. Well, it seems like it's working, and congratulations to you, and long may it continue to grow. The more media voices we have, the better for everybody. I know that you have some very strong views about the media world at the moment in South Africa and the kinds of opinions that we hear in South African media. Do you want to give us an overview of how you're feeling about the news sources that you use for the morning shot and the ones who shouldn't be trusted at all?
Well, it's not so much the sources as opposed to the people who write them. Unfortunately, or coincidentally, a lot of news is going behind paywalls these days,
yeah,
which helps me immensely. The problem with paywalls is you need to have quality behind those paywalls, and most of the paywalls are just not worth the money at this rate. But the big problem with the news, generally speaking, is that I suspect as a reporter or as a journalist, you are focused on the day-to-day stories. You don't look at the mega trends or the super trends mm-hmm. in those stories. So it's important to look at the news and analyze it over a long period of time and look at the trends that are happening rather than focusing on the story of the day.
Very, very good. Canton, nice to see you. How are you this morning?
Excellent, guys. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, good. Fine. Thursday morning, we're heading towards spring. Things are good. I'm not going to complain too much. And, of course, we are coming out of the tyrannical lockdown, even if it is only a step at a time. So, Canton, I know you've got lots to talk to Roman about, but he just explained to us what the morning shot is, and for people who haven't heard it before, that seems to be doing extremely well. Are we at the Kabanak household lockdown level yet? Because for most people, this is still very oppressive. There are still some people who think that we should have more of a lockdown at this stage. Looking back now at March the 26th, when it all started, this has been one hell of a journey. There are still places in the world that we would think would be free, like New York City, where despite the fact that they're getting four new cases a week or something small like that, it's a tiny, tiny number of cases that are coming up in places like New York. The governor and the mayor of New York refused to open it up. They refused to unlock. And obviously this is political. And in South Africa, it may be part of a political plan, too, to not have any exit strategy for lockdown. Or do you think that we're moving in a positive direction?
Is there any of us who actually believes for a second that this government of ours knows what they are doing at any level?
Well, I'm a silver lining kind of guy. And I do believe that while this lockdown has hit them as hard as it's hit anyone else in the world, and they had no idea of what to do in the beginning, I do think they've seen the advantages through the last few months. It takes them a long while to learn. They're not very bright. But it is possible to see that they have grasped the fact that this lockdown may give them powers and authority that heretofore were out of their reach. They can use the COVID excuse for a lot of things, and they have tried, and some of them have succeeded, and some have failed.
The stuff that I think that's far more insidious, guys, is the fact that they've actually used the opportunity. Well, people have been blindsided by the lockdown, our obsession with alcohol, our obsession with tobacco, to gazette stuff that we haven't been paying attention to. So the most pernicious, for example, is the changes to the BEE codes.
And the Film and Publications Act.
Exactly, yeah. So they're two absolutely critical pieces of legislation which are not related to the lockdown at any level. It just so happens that because we've been so distracted by the lockdown, we haven't been drawing attention to that stuff at the level that we need to be drawing attention.
Can we draw attention to those two things this morning, even if it's just for the first little bit of the Burning Platform? So first of all, Canton, you've been in the media a long time. You know what the Film and Publications Act is meant to achieve, who it's meant to protect and what it's there for. But government have a very different idea of what its purpose is. And this is a very dangerous act because they're going to try to seize control of who can and cannot say things on the internet, which sites can open themselves up and which cannot, how to throttle certain kinds of information. It's a very, very dangerous piece of legislation that they're tabling.
Well, I think one of the issues for a lot of people in government has been the fact that they've been unable to regulate platforms such as the one we're on right now, or the one that Roman has now started up. In fact, all of these podcasters around the country who've been coming to the party and providing really critically important insights into what's going on in the country that is just not getting covered at any level by the mainstream media. And the question really on their minds has been to try and work out how to actually put some level of control upon these platforms. I actually expected that the first port of call for them would have been to go via the Human Rights Commission, because that happens to be their go-to Rottweiler for lots of things. I tend to end up ignoring the Human Rights Commission by and large, because their ability to actually cause lasting damage is really quite limited if you think about it. But trying to actually put in place a legislative framework that will potentially end up tying up the likes of germ warfare, as an example, in essentially legal wranglings. Because fundamentally, if you look at the pattern that happens in other parts of the world, the core of cancel culture is to try and basically bludgeon alternative voices into submission. And legal costs can very quickly shut down a voice that is on the fringe as far as the mainstream is concerned, just simply because they can't afford to stay in the game.
But that's
concerning stuff.
But surely if the government have intentions to shut down voices like Roman's through the new Film and Publications Act, surely they also then have to, by virtue of that legislation being effective, they have to then also target massive social media platforms and businesses like Google, because those people are as much a platform for Roman or for anyone else as their own platform is. Of course, that's where he lives, but he can quite easily spread his stuff on Twitter or Instagram or Google or Facebook or anywhere else. And they have no hope in hell of restricting our access to that stuff, do they?
No, they don't. But they do have the ability to go after people one person at a time, which really is the point of concern. Because you essentially pick and choose your targets. So and we've seen this pattern happen across the pond in the US. And, and essentially it's the same playbook that they are working on. And they will try and go after people one-on-one. One of the problems that they have to deal with, though, is the whole question of jurisdiction. And they have to actually come up with some sort of reasonable way of trying to show that they do have jurisdiction over the stuff that's being put out. And
so if they went after Rahman, for example, and they decided he was target number one, could he not just move his business to Malta or to Mauritius or to anywhere else, have it registered there or have his servers there? And then they're outside the jurisdiction of this government.
Well, technically, if you look in terms of the governmental jurisdiction, and what is that idiot Greek guy who dropped a K-bomb up in holiday?
Adam Katsavelos.
Yeah, Katsavelos, you know, as a specific example. You see, to my mind, it was very clear that even though I have, you know, significant issues with the guy being an asshole, that we don't have jurisdiction, because it's an offense that was committed on foreign soil, and it's up to the people in Greece to basically end up trying him and convicting him if it happens to be a crime in that neck of the woods. Yeah. Now, instead, what happened was, I suppose, bowing to family pressure and all of that kind of stuff, because there was massive pressure brought to bear in terms of the guy's business, and clearly the Greek lobby in South Africa has a very keen interest in actually ensuring that this network of Greek businesses don't get toppled. I mean, you consider the fact that Greek South Africans have done very well in terms of particularly the restaurant business.
Yes. That seems quite obvious from the way that people were more than happy to give up all of their... there's an argument that we had on the TV show last night. Hlanganisi, who you remember from a previous Burning Platform, Canton, was very much of the opinion that our rights have not been in any way infringed during this lockdown. I know Rahman has a completely contrary view, as did the other two guests, Solly Moeng and Ras Lamberti, last night. But we have had a massive predation upon the basic rights of South Africans, the right to association, the right to movement, the right to purchase the things we want, the right to free expression in very many cases. I mean, there are rules that have come into play during lockdown that have reminded people like me just how extremely fragile the constructions that hold up our rights actually are. Would you agree with that, Rahman?
I mean, it's amazing that someone would say that when Colin Corso was shot for having a beer in his garden.
Mm-hmm.
But, so how many rights were infringed when he died? Many.
All.
Right? We have all been under house arrest for 4.5 months. We're not allowed to travel where we want. We're not allowed to see people that we want. Those are all rights that have been extinguished in the name of safety. I mean, the assumption that no rights have been trampled on a bigger belief at this stage. But I've actually forgot your question, Gareth.
No, the question is, okay, so going back to the Film and Publications Act, for example, I think that this is an issue of free expression. Obviously, in America, they have a First Amendment, which protects that. In South Africa, we have our Bill of Rights. And the right to free expression is very much at the front and center of our Constitution. In fact, in order to make any changes to that, we would require, I think it's 75% of our legislature to make an amendment or a change to that Bill of Rights. So enshrined is it in our principles as a country. Do you believe, though, that government have any interest in looking after that Bill of Rights? We've seen during this lockdown that they clearly do not.
No, absolutely not. But remember, I mean, the Constitution says one thing about freedom of speech, but then they developed what's called PAPUDA, which is the Promotion of Something or Other Act in 98 or 99, and that created the Equality Court. That created a lot of these other kangaroo courts, and the definition of free speech in PAPUDA is much narrower than the definition of free speech in the Constitution. And then I think what's his name,
surely,
John Quilani.
Surely then if it was challenged, if this was taken to the Constitutional Court, and it came up that this act, whatever it is that you've just mentioned now, up against the Constitution, the one is superior to the other.
Well, it was challenged late last year by John Quilani, who said, he said gay marriage is not okay all those years ago. And the SCA, the Supreme Court of Appeal, found that certain parts of PAPUDA are actually unconstitutional. But since then, nothing much has happened.
So they haven't struck it down.
All right. No, but okay. all the elements of the Equality Court beforehand could possibly be unconstitutional, but no one took it a step further.
I don't want to waste time because it's to have both of you on the Burning Platform today is a really good thing. So I want to go to what Canthan raised a little bit earlier, because we've now discussed, I think, the Film and Publications Act to some degree, not to the degree that I'd want to, but let's just move to the BEE codes, because you mentioned that, Canthan, as an area where government has been surreptitiously changing things without our notice.
That's quite right.
What's going on there?
Well, the last codes that were gazetted, which I think was sometime in mid-July, Gareth, has become a correction, but effectively will allow government to come into your business and impose quotas on the basis of race within your individual business. So it no longer becomes a question of having broad codes that you are meant to try and honor the spirit of. You know, for example, these broad brushstrokes that come up with the idea that you need to apply demographics in terms of hiring. Yes. But again, it's one of those cases where government has always rigged the playing fields. So for low-paying jobs, they want to apply local demographics. For high-paying jobs, they want to apply national demographics. So what this means, for example, is that if you happen to live in the Western Cape, even though the overwhelming majority of people who live in the Western Cape are people who used to be classified as colored under apartheid, for hiring your upper echelon, so your well-paid managers, you have to apply national demographics, which means that you're forcing people who consider themselves colored into a minority role in terms of upper management. And it's utterly pernicious. But more to the point, government is now giving to themselves the ability to come into your business and actually enforce that. So, in other words, if I want to hire a management team that happens to be entirely composed of white women, as an example, I would not be allowed to do that in terms of these codes.
Even as a private business?
As a private business, exactly, yes.
But this is this is unenforceable.
Well, is it? Well, actually, it does end up being enforceable, because ultimately you have to sign up those people for tax, you have to sign up. The extent to which government is able to step in and actually enforce this is actually quite substantial, if you think about it.
I was talking about this just a few nights ago. So the problem is BEE as it stands now, and it hasn't gone as far as this new BEE code seems to want to go, has been an abject failure. It has been disastrous certainly for small black businesses. It's been an opportunity for fronting and all kinds of other dangerous and not necessarily honest practices in white businesses or old corporate South Africa, where they've really just been ticking the boxes and doing whatever they could to comply with the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And we know that government has got no leg to stand on when it comes to trying to defend BEE. All it's done is made the elites in the ANC that much richer at the expense of young black entrepreneurs and people who have really good ideas and people who could ostensibly start their own businesses with less of the red tape around them. It's done nothing to help small businesses, either black, white, colored, or Indian in this country, in any which way. And that is, I think, an accepted fact. Yet this seems to be the central tent peg of so much of the ANC's economic policy to an obsessive degree.
Well, it allows them to be very selective in terms of how it gets applied. And fundamentally, it comes back to the whole concept of cadre deployment, which, again, that effectively becomes the way of the ANC continuing to feed at the trough and to give as many seats at the table to as many of its members as they possibly can. Look, frankly, I think what needs to happen is that we need to be systematically boycotting businesses that are going out of their way to hire people who are closely connected with the ruling party at some level. Now, if you consider that there are just so many of the larger businesses that make these very high-profile appointments onto their boards that are very closely connected to the ANC, which is further entrenching that entire system, you know, rather than trying to tear it down. But at the same time, I think that there's a very strong case to be made for coming up with a means for upright citizens. And I'm talking very specifically about black people who are not in the government's net at any level, who are actually, you know, they've paid their dues, they've got their degrees, they're highly qualified, and they cannot get jobs based on the fact that cadre deployment is the norm. And perhaps what we need is some sort of code that people sign up to that says that I swear under risk of perjury that I am no way associated with government and that I do not benefit at any level from any tenders or kickbacks or any processes that happen within the ranks of the political parties. And businesses should go out of their way to only hire people who tick those boxes and who are able to make those declarations.
Roman, you've got some things to say about this, and then I have a suggestion from a professor emeritus from Rhodes, which I think I'd like to hear your thoughts on as well. But what do you want to say about this whole BEE code?
Well, you say that BEE is a failure. I say it's a great success. If you think BEE is about upliftment and opportunity, that's sort of the propaganda that's been pushed around it. BEE is the capture of private sector by ANC cadres. That's all it is, and that's all it has been for 20 years. And now, under the duress of the new codes, the ANC will basically do pencil tests in every business in South Africa to ensure the cadres are adequately represented. But also, most importantly, the ANC are not the ones that are enforcing this. The corporates are enforcing this.
Yeah, they're doing the dirty work for the ANC.
I mean, the chairman of MTN is the former deputy finance minister, right? It's Jonas. Trevor Manuel is the chairman of Old Mutual. I mean, these are all ANC guys who are in the private sector of these multi-billion rand corporates. Why? Because they wonderfully strategic, bright, and deserve to be there, or because they are ANC cadres, and that's what the ANC does, and the corporates want to curry favor, so they hire ANC cadres to do it. And that's always been the role of BEE, so I think it's been a wonderful success for the ANC.
Fair enough. Yeah, the sarcasm dripping from your mouth as you speak. What about this suggestion? There's a Professor Fowler, who's a professor emeritus of Rhodes. He suggested the other day, and I thought this was quite an interesting idea because we are looking for solutions instead of just talking ourselves into circles. He said that if the president is serious about fighting corruption, and if the ANC, let's say that they discover their spines and their balls and they decide to do something principled over something which is self-serving, the best way to deal with this is declare an amnesty. But everyone who has partaken in any tenderpreneurship or suspect activity, you know, these politically exposed individuals, as they refer to them, has an opportunity to declare what they've done, to give the money back, at least what percentage they can, including their salaries that they earned during the corrupt activities they were partaking in, and thereby exempt themselves from having to go to jail. In other words, pay back the money and you won't have to be punished for the rest of your life.
And which is all nice and well, Gareth, except no one's gone to jail.
No, well, this is the point. But if we now declare an amnesty and we pursue to the full extent of the law those who do not declare themselves, in other words, those who choose to stay stum about what they've stolen, those people will obviously have to go to jail. They'll have to be arrested. They'll have to be pursued to the full extent of the law, and there will be no mercy shown. Is there any possibility that this might attract at least a few people who are frightened that the long arm of the law eventually will come to them, Or do you think that this is pie in the sky?
I think it's pie in the sky because we have not had a single high-profile case being brought before the courts at this point. We have not had people going to jail. Ramaphosa has been in power now for, what, 3 years? And how many people have we seen go to jail? We have had, what, 600,000 people charged under lockdown regulations.
Yeah.
It was very easy for them to do that. So this entire idea of having a sort of TRC round two for corruption is really what it is. It's never going to end up actually going anywhere other than, look, from the point of view of someone who is actually involved in this criminality and continues to loot, mm-hmm. What is the incentive right now? Unless they actually see people getting arrested and going to jail, that's the only reason why they would actually stop.
And it also seems, I mean, to add value to your point, it seems that the more you've stolen, the less likely you are to go to jail. It's the small, petty ones that they make an occasional lip service arrest. And, you know, someone in the municipality in Polokwane at like third branch level gets arrested and they think, well, that'll satisfy them for now. The guys are stealing millions and millions and millions. Those people, just they go to Dubai.
Yeah, but it's also the modus operandi of the government. You have there's a disaster. You have a commission of inquiry or a TRC or something. Everything gets aired, and then everything gets swept under the carpet later. Nothing actually happens after that, right? And if you look at the original TRC, just the amount of just blatant fraud and corruption in that TRC hearing, and how they basically said, you know, ANC did nothing wrong, and you know, Eugene the Cock did everything wrong. You don't get clarity on the situation whatsoever, and in fact, there is no solution granted. It's just a.
So when you see the Zondo Commission, do you think that's just a total waste of time?
Well, I mean, just based on the evidence, especially now that the Zondo Commission, in their terms of reference, can the MPA can now prosecute. I mean, the Zondo Commission's been going on for 18 months, 2 years now. Mm-hmm. Just on testimony, people should be prosecuted and jailed by now, but it just doesn't seem to happen at all. So I don't. It might be useful for some elements of the ANC to have Zondo Commission carrying on, as they only implemented it under duress through a court order. But other than that, I don't see any form of conclusion being reached.
Then it is worth giving credit to Jacob Zuma for having been a man of some ability to wreak havoc in some people's opinions, but certainly to affect the ability of the criminal justice system to do its job. He has completely eviscerated that entire cluster in the state. He's made it impossible. And Shamila Batoy doesn't seem like she's in any hurry to pick up the pieces and start rebuilding it, even though we occasionally hear empty words coming from her. As you say, no prosecutions, no important arrests, none of that stuff's been happening.
No, not at all. And if you look, there are actually budget cuts happening to the National Prosecuting Authority. They'll need to let 550 people go if their budget is not increased this year. So there's no, I mean, it's a bit like land reform. It gets the lowest budget out of all the ministries, and then people hype it up to be like the most important function of the state. Just look where the money's going, guys, and then you can see how important it is.
Tell me quickly, Raman, you've looked at the numbers from lockdown, and you think South Africa's finished?
For the most part, yes. So there was a StatsSA study done. It was published in MoneyWeb 2 days ago. So I did this video 2 days ago, so I'm going to be way off. But restaurants down 99%. Tourism down basically 100%. Car sales and motor trade down 49%, I think, mm-hmm. In the second quarter of 2020. These are millions of people's livelihoods destroyed. The alcohol ban destroyed, 40,000 taverns around the country. I don't see in the social construct called South Africa the economy recovering in any meaningful way. This lockdown has destroyed another decade of potential prosperousness. in South Africa. And I just don't see a way back for the country. I see a way back for people generally, if they build robust, resilient communities and protect themselves from state predation. But as a country, as, you know, this thing we call South Africa, there's no recovery within the next 10 years.
You want to add anything to that, Canton? It's pretty miserable, but I mean, I can't argue. Based on the statistics, it seems like an inevitability that we're going to have to climb this hill again, a hill that we were slowly starting to get up.
Yeah, look, I don't know about whether it's miserable, but I think one of the points that I've been making for quite a while now is that it has to get worse before it gets better. And I think an important result of this, even though it's disastrous for the economy as a whole, is that it's actually putting the squeeze on the amount of revenue that's now flowing into the coffers of government directly. And so ditto in the case of the alcohol ban, ditto in the case of the tobacco ban. Ultimately, this means money that has not been flowing into the pockets of SARS, which ultimately means less money flowing into the pockets of government at a number of levels. Look, no doubt they're going to do what we've spoken about quite often, which is going after pension funds, because that is low-hanging fruit. But one of the things that we need to give South Africans credit for is that we have this ability to actually work around problems whenever they come along. And so if you look particularly in terms of the way in which cigarettes continue to flow during the period when they were purportedly banned.
Yeah.
That's an indication that we actually have the ability to put in place alternative systems that bypass the existing ones. And I think that we are at the point right now where it really becomes our patriotic duty to do everything that we possibly can to keep as much money out of the hands of government as we possibly can.
Well,
and that means doing, you know, very basic things like agreeing to barter services.
Yes, absolutely. And people will trade in things like Bitcoin and perhaps in gold, rather than, if it's a personal transaction between Roman and you and I, for example, rather than actually leave a paper trail or use the banks, because we know the banks are forced to be the handmaiden of government in terms of what SARS can do and access and what they can find out. But Canton, surely that's inevitable anyway, because a lot of businesses have shut down, and those who have been running will probably declare a loss. I don't think anyone except maybe Tito Mboweni in the ANC has even considered just how the taps have run dry. And there's going to be a huge rude awakening. I mean, this is tax month for a lot of people, right? Provisional tax month. So anyone who's paying provisional tax this month will have noticed that they're not paying that much on this year, because there hasn't been that much trade. And therefore, the money that they would have paid last year to SARS is probably diminished by, I don't know, a quarter, maybe in some cases, all of it. Maybe people will not even be paying provisional tax this year because of the lockdown. That's bound to have a knock-on effect, even if the people in the ANC don't realize it now. They will by the time that SARS does its calculations.
But again, this actually requires that they have some fundamental understanding of how the economy actually works. Truth be told, apart from Tito Mboweni, who happens to be Goldman Sachs trained and actually understands the way in which to run large economies, it doesn't mean that he wants to run it in the way that I'd like him to run it, but he does have a clear understanding of what's actually necessary to keep the taps flowing. And he is being kneecapped at every stage. So when you have other idiots like, I don't want to call her an idiot directly, because then, you know, she'll probably end up suing me. But a certain minister who decides in her infinite wisdom that, you know, closing down the tobacco industry is a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. But this is something I want to ask you both about. There are ministers like Fikile Mbalula, who's now making overtures to that minister you just spoke of, by trying to get the drunk driving limits completely reduced to zero. In other words, that any drunk driving, it's really a gesture. He's not going to improve anybody's lives. He's not going to necessarily save any lives. And we're all against drunk driving. But Fikile Mbalula, in his wisdom, believes that by making a law, it's going to be executed perfectly in every set of circumstances. These people actually think that politics is the art of the possible, that they can sit and come up with something and it will be carried out. I mean, like Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma probably thought when she made the ban on tobacco that that would stop smoking in South Africa. They're idealists.
But, yes, absolutely. But understand the level of idiocy here. Every time there happens to be a situation where someone is caught driving at a very high speed, so something like, 200 kilometers per hour.
Okay.
They get clocked. And what's the first thing that the Minister of Transport, irrespective of who the Minister of Transport happens to be, mm-hmm. the first thing that the Minister of Transport comes out with is we need to reduce the speed limit. Now, hang on a second. Everyone is driving happily at 120 Ks. You have one person
right.
who has clocked 200. How is making everyone else drive slowly going to actually fix the problem of one person breaking the law?
Well, they've got...
And it is that fundamental lack of understanding.
Yeah, but they've only got one lever.
It's the law of the instrument. When the only thing you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
What do you think, Raman?
Well, I think, just beside the point, there's going to be a trend of alcohol restriction. You can see it starting to happen already. Over the weekend, I think three police officers and someone else died in a head-on collision.
Mm-hmm. There was a high-speed chase.
And the claim is the person who was driving the other car was drunk. That person's dead. How are you going to do a test to see whether they were drunk or not? You cannot prove the claim that person was drunk. Then you look at the 0% alcohol limits, which is dumb because if you eat sourdough bread, you can be above 0%. That's mm-hmm. why that's why the limit is fairly not high by any means, but there is a gap there for people. And you metabolize alcohol in a different way entirely. And then also, if you look at Panyazo the Sufi saying alcohol-free South Africa is the way to go, the problem with the government, they look at the consequences and they want to limit the consequences of something, or they want to limit the symptoms of something, but they don't look at the underlying cause of something. And when you're just fighting the smoke at the top, you never see the fire at the bottom and try to extinguish that fire. And that's all governments generally all over the world do. They look at symptoms, they input a law, then there's other symptoms from that law, and then they fight those. But they never look at the underlying thing, which is why are 17% of South Africans binge drinkers? Mm-hmm. That's the key, not how people drive.
Because most of them can't get jobs, and they have bad family arrangements, and a lot of this is very messy. It's very, very messy, and it has to do with those social problems, which no one wants to deal with because they require an enormous amount of energy and time, and not just money, and not just laws.
Look, in terms of the cracking down on the limits in terms of driving, one of my issues is that your ability to actually enforce it really goes out the window. So effectively, you end up with a scenario where people get arrested on the basis of suspicion, because you've enforced a zero tolerance limit. You hit someone with a breathalyzer, mm-hmm. Which is not able to potentially pick that up. And so what do? You arrest the person, you take them in for a blood test. And it really ends up then becoming this clusterfuck of note, because there is no way to actually enforce it based on the technology that's available. Where does this end up leaving us? Well, ultimately, if you look in terms of what the roadmap has been around the way people have been managing drunk driving, mm-hmm. people have not been going out in the evenings. They've been drinking at home because they've been wanting to avoid those scenarios.
Yeah.
You've had things like ride-hailing companies that have come to the party, and they've created safe means of people being able to get to and from places where they've been drinking.
Yeah.
And ultimately, these are solutions that actually end up being in the purview of people who can actually afford them.
Correct. So again, you punish the poor people.
But you're punishing the poor people, right? And so we're getting back to that. So again, if you look in terms of of public transport in this country. A friend of mine from across the pond made this point to me, which was actually quite a bit of a revelation. He says, you know, we don't have public transport in South Africa. What we have is commuter transport.
Mm.
And so really what that means is that the entire transport infrastructure, such as it is not geared towards being able to take people from point A to point B, including the last mile, whenever they happen to want to be able to do it. You know, so for example, in most first world countries, and in fact, if you look at third world countries, like look at India, look at China, you can pretty much get public transport at any time of day in those countries to get from one place to another. But again, because we've had the entire infrastructure, the transport infrastructure of this country being absolutely gutted by the ANC's inefficiencies.
No, it's on purpose. They do this because many ANC people own the taxis.
Yes, absolutely.
This is not an incompetence. This is actually a huge degree of competence. They've made it look like, which is tremendous work on their part. It proves they can do something when they really want to. The ANC is actually in charge of transport in this country. And for poor people, there are no alternatives because they've removed them all.
That's right. And as soon as you have a scenario where people try to provide alternatives, I mean, consider all of those businesses that have tried to provide late-night public transport to townships.
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably, those vehicles end up getting targeted.
Yep, correct.
By the taxi associations.
So, guys, I want to move over to America because we're only a couple of weeks away from the U.S. elections, and there is so much about that which affects the whole world. So before anybody says we haven't spent enough time on South Africa this morning, we have a full 46 minutes. I want to, in the last remaining 13 or so minutes, let's just talk a little bit about what's going on in America. There have been riots now in Kenosha, which is in Wisconsin. It's always these Democrat states. There's a Democratic governor. There's a Democratic mayor. Why is this happening? I mean, we know in this case that the event that triggered it is a 17-year-old who was arrested and charged with homicide. And then there was a police shooting of a black man. So all of this seems, of course, we don't know because we can't, the police, the authorities in Kenosha are not telling us whether or not this guy was going for a gun when the police shot him or not. And these things always emerge after the fact, but the riots started with or without any knowledge of that detail. And Kenosha is just the next in a long list of places, Portland, Seattle, Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, where all of this has been happening over the last while. It's hard not to think that this is a coordinated effort. Who would be coordinating such a thing? What is the political upside for people who might be on that side? And what is the political downside for them in the long run coming up to this election? How do you think this is going to play out for a Trump versus Biden match in November?
Well, I think it's important to remember Wisconsin is a swing state, right? The other states are broadly Democratic states. Wisconsin changes every election cycle. And as for swing states, they're vitally important. That's where presidential candidates focus on to make sure the swing states goes to them.
Famously, Hillary did not focus on Wisconsin in 2016, and it was one of the reasons she lost.
Indeed. And Trump won that state by 70,000 votes. It's like very, very close. So in this particular regard, Jacob Blake was shot by the police 7 times. He's not dead, but he might be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. This is someone who has been charged with sexual assault and robbery before a warrant of arrest was issued in July this year, but they didn't find him, and now they did find him. So based on who you follow, he was trying to break up a domestic incident. Based on some other stories, he was an essential element of that domestic incident. Mm-hmm. And I think this is George Floyd 2.0. It gives impetus to Black Lives Matter and Antifa to come in and destroy, you know, so-called white supremacy. But what is interesting in Kenosha in particular is that you have these militia groups coming as well. I think the 17-year-old who had an AR-15 who was being attacked and he shot 2 people, he was from Portland. He's not from Kenosha. So people are traveling with Black Lives Matter to fight Black Lives Matter, wherever Black Lives Matter happened to be, even if it's not their particular area. geographical area where they live. So he's
They're importing violence.
To some degree, I think you have BLM moving across the country, and then you have these people that are fighting BLM moving along with BLM. So you're creating this, not a civil war by any means, but you're creating these two distinct groups who are fighting different styles. To me, I think if Donald Trump is the law and order candidate, which he is, if he wants more police funding, which he does, and if he sends his National Guard, which he is as well, it's just a question of letting this happen, and he will come out much stronger for it. Joe Biden said he wants to defund the police because Joe Biden has no original ideas. So he just picks them from the squad and others. It's weird. Black Lives Matter only happens during election year, every 4 years. And it's well orchestrated. The organization itself, the institution itself is well funded. And it's almost James Lindsay, who's a very great critical theorist critic, calls it, it's sort of like the cultural revolution in a way, where you have these bands of hardcore communist socialists roving around the country, destroying elements of American culture to build a new one, a more equitable one. And I think to some degree that is what is happening.
Well, I think the interesting thing for me in terms of the Republican convention is the way in which Trump has been playing the race card. And he's been playing the race card by trotting out these very high-profile black supporters of his campaign. So you have Herschel Walker. He's a football great from years ago, standing up and saying that, you know, he's known Donald Trump for more than 30 years, and the man is a mensch, and that anyone who turns around and says that Trump is a racist is absolutely clueless, because he's known the man for that long, and he's their kids have grown up together, and he's refusing to accept anyone who says that that the man is a racist. Trump also he issued a very high profile pardon to a guy who was serving a prison term for who served a 5-year term for bank robbery, and who now runs an NGO that's helping former prisoners re-enter society. And he's trotted out black Republicans from the House. He's also trotted out the solitary black member of black Republican senator in his support. Mm-hmm. And it's been very carefully curated. He's not at any levels saying, I'm not a racist, some of my best friends are black. What he's doing is allowing people whose credibility is really unassailable to actually come forward and say, you know, I'm supporting Trump. And it's a really interesting tactic. And the other thing is that if you look in terms of the spend that Trump has been putting in. Consider that when he was running against Hillary, he ran literally on a shoestring budget at the time. Mm-hmm. Now he's actually running a relatively substantial campaign this time around. And so it's looking more like the way in which traditional campaigns used to be, still are run that way from the Democrats' point of view.
And can you contrast this with the Democratic National Convention just last week? How do you see the two lining up and squaring up? What do you think the main offering on both sides actually whittles down to? Canton?
I had difficulty actually coming with a single takeaway from the Democratic National Convention in terms of what they actually stand for versus what they stand against.
Well, we know they stand against Donald Trump. That seems
exactly.
That seems to be the overriding ideology, is that he's a bad person.
But I do think that, you know, by and large, you can persuade people that Donald Trump is a bad person. But is their disdain for Donald Trump as a person going to be, let's say, best expressed by the way to vote for Joe Biden? That becomes the question, really. Because remember last time round, it wasn't that people liked Donald Trump. It's just that they disliked him less than they disliked Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
in terms of voting patterns.
I think the Democrats are building their entire campaign around the fact that they think that Donald Trump is more distasteful to most people, particularly in suburbia, than Joe Biden is. That Joe Biden's just this kindly old dotty uncle who really doesn't do anything too egregious. He's been in politics all his life. He hasn't really ever done anything else. And for the half century that he's been in American politics, he hasn't done anything too terrible. He just hasn't done anything really noteworthy either. Would you say that's fair, Roman?
Well, I think Joe Biden has done horrific things. He signed the crime bills in the early 90s with Clinton.
Those were the only things that he could have put on his record before, but he's now distanced himself from them.
Yeah, of course. No, conveniently. And people change. Don't get me wrong. People change.
And he was also against gay marriage. Let's remember that.
Well, up to Donald Trump, every presidential candidate in history has been against gay marriage, including Barack Obama, who only changed his mind in his second term.
Well, he changed his mind because the courts forced him to.
Right. Donald Trump's the first person to ever have campaigned openly as being for gay marriage.
And absolutely won. Right. Yes.
And he also put out, just in terms of gay marriage, he put out an international, at the UN, I believe, like an international sort of measure that gay people should be protected based on their sexuality and not discriminated against. This is like an international, I don't know whether regulation or policy, first president to ever do this. But I mean, I want to ask a question, and predictions are always, the wrong thing to do, but I can't see anything other than a landslide for Trump here. I know the polls are all over the place. I know that there's a lot of uncertainty, but Don Lemon, my favorite journalist on CNN, says the riots need to stop because it's showing up in the polling. Not because they're destructive, not because 30 people have been killed since George Floyd died, not because of the destruction of property and businesses across USA. He says riots need to stop because of showing up in the polling. And that statement he made was
extraordinarily cynical.
No, but it's just so extraordinary, like Dunning-Kruger elitist ignoramuses for the most part. And if that's the sort of analysis you have about the riots, not that it's illegal and criminal and should be shut down immediately, and Trump does say all those things, I don't know. Like, I just don't see Trump losing this one.
Yeah. I tend to agree with Roman.
But guys, he is his own worst enemy. I mean, his tweets, his interactions.
Oh no! I don't buy that for a second. It's like people who say that Helen Zille's her own worst enemy. I think that Helen Zille's popularity with the masses of this country continues to be at the high that it always was, and frankly, that if she were to run for election again as leader of the DA, then people would turn up in their numbers to vote for her. I think that there's a sense of forthrightness that people actually end up appreciating, even though cancel culture tries to say things to the contrary, like, he's his own worst enemy or things like that. No, I don't buy that for a second. I disagree with a lot of stuff that...
Thanks very much. You're throwing me in with cancel culture, are you? Thank you. I appreciate that very much. That's nice.
It couldn't have been the worst there, Gareth. Really.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, unfortunately, we're out of time. Roman, we will have you back. And your microphone did improve substantially after Canton said, my God, you sound terrible. Luckily, on the morning shot, you won't hear his microphone sounding terrible. Canton, thank you for joining us, as always. And a big thank you to Nando's for making it possible every single week for us to discuss this range of interesting topics we covered today and many, many more. So we will have a new episode for you next week. But if you missed anything today, it will be available as a podcast. And
I just want to say, Gareth, on that note, that very quick pickup from Nando's in terms of Tito's chicken.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you actually got that.
Excellent
yeah,
work.
It was brilliant, yes.
Superb. All right. So any parting words from you, Roman? Anything else you'd like to say? Canton, anything you want to throw in before we wrap it up?
The beatings will continue until morale improves.
All right. Thank you, Canton. Nothing else from you, Roman?
Nothing else from me. Thank you for your kind invitation, and I will be glad to be back.
All right. We will have this available for you as a podcast momentarily. CliffCentral.com, Thursday morning. Thank you for joining us. CliffCentral.com.